Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This episode is one I've been looking forward to for a while now. We sat down with Nick Woplington, artist and photographer. He's a person I've known for years now. He was a friend of the magazines. And Joe Talbot, frontman and singer-songwriter of Idols. Joe's work and Idols are producing some of the most interesting hard-driving rock at the moment. There's an honesty and an energy about their live performances. And the work they do really does turn a gimlet eye on the hypocrisies and the injustices, particularly of contemporary Britain and the world. And Nick's built a huge body of work over the last 20, 30 years, having established himself in the 90s with books like Living Room and Safety in Numbers as someone that makes documentary art, which might seem a contradiction. But if you know Nick's work, you'll know it's not. Anyway, since those days of being thought of as mainly a photographer, he's also created a huge body of work in painting and drawing. And yet he still remains the only photographer to have a solo show at the Tate, with a series of pictures that he made in collaboration with Alexander McQueen backstage at one of his last shows. And we met in Nick's studio in the dog day of August, towards the end of the first London lockdown. A strange day in the silence that replaced what should have been Notting Hill Carnival weekend. And I just had a feeling there'd be some kind of invisible thread between these two people we've never met before. There's 20 years apart in age, doing vastly different work, but there's something that connects them, and I was just really interested to see what emerged. This is Joining the Dots. Joining the Dots is the podcast from the makers of Huck magazine. My name's Mike Fordham, one of the founding editors. And the podcast is about conversations across culture, where we sit down with people making stuff, creating culture in their own image, from artists and musicians to activists and political people, all paddling against the flow, all defining who they are in opposition to the mainstream. We find the things that draw us together as well as the things that tear us apart. Okay, so I don't know what you guys know about each other, and I thought we could just find out, and that's a nice thing. But I've known Nick for a number of years now. I met you sort of in mid-90s, I guess, lurking around Shoreditch at Dazed and other places. And Joe, we've never met. But we've got some, well, we actually met in Bristol, which is a weird connection.
I served you a pint.
Yeah, which is strange. It interests me to get people like you in the same room together, and that's the point of this series of talks we're having, is that I feel like you're artists that sort of, there's some relationship there, and I can't really work out what it is. I mean, you're about to launch album number 3, I believe.
Yes.
Called?
Ultra Mono.
And Nick is about to drop a book called Anagalypta, I believe.
It is, yes. It's called Anaglypse, yeah.
Which I don't understand. Anaglypse,
the term, is a type of wallpaper that was popular in the 60s and 70s. And it has, you used to see it a lot on the ceilings of pubs. There'd be these kind of square boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, they'd have it everywhere in pubs. And I used to photograph a glue sniffer a lot, a guy called Lucky Jim. And he really, really liked to go into pubs after he'd been glue sniffing and buy half a lager and look at the Anaglypse ceilings, because they'd help him trip, because the squares would come down from the roof. So the term actually came from him. And I like it, it's a beautiful word.
It is a lovely word.
Yeah, it's a lovely word, and it just describes these kind of boring, seemingly boring ceiling tiles that you see everywhere. You used to get them, of course, the wallpaper in, as well, in, you know, cheap bedsits and whatever, at one time.
I always find that there's a real violence to 70s decor. My great grandfather and his brother, Pops, who lived in like houses, and my grandfather as well, he was an engineer, so he liked to do all his own decorating. And like, I can't remember, I can remember there being in the bathroom, avocado, everything, and textured, heavily textured wallpaper. I remember that. And I love it. I love that. I love the detail of things like Anaglypta wallpaper and like, just like ornate plastering and things like that. Stuff that you just don't see as much. Obviously for good reason, like, you know, minimalism. And, you know, there's something calming about it. The 70s doesn't seem like a very calming time, but.
So why did you focus on that for the collection? What, tell us about the book a bit.
The book is a collection of kind of 500 pictures, of which about 95% of them I've never published before. They're pictures that I kind of taken on the go by just having a small camera on me from the kind of the age of 14 onwards, mixed up with a few kind of more conceptual projects and a project I did for Art Forum. And then I kind of made this long non-linear journey through the kind of 40-year period, with a kind of slight focus on the idea of how this guy Jim used to talk to him a lot when I was photographing him for a few years, his kind of trippy journeys that he went on when he was high, or when, you know, or he was going to look for Evo Stick, because what he really liked was the active ingredient in old school Evo Stick, but they discontinued it by the late 1980s. So he'd go on these bus journeys around the Midlands looking for like out of the way home decor shops where they might have old stock. And then he'd buy it all up and then have a kind of supply of it for a while. And he was really dedicated to this kind of hallucinogen. I should find out what the active ingredient is called, but yeah, obviously it's a drug that's gone now.
Because the things you photographed, I was trying to work out, and I've said this to you before, when I first met you, everyone you referred to as old Nick, the hardcore reportage photographer, and that was probably 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Just after the Living Room pictures came out, right?
Yes.
It's in Nottingham. Tell us a bit about that. Is it Nottingham?
No, before. I mean, you know, my grandfather lived on a council estate to the north of Nottingham, between Nottingham and Derby, really. It's a kind of, in an area where there had been coal mines, and the coal mines were gone. And by the mid-1980s, it became a dump estate where they put all the problem families. And so I was there taking pictures, and I didn't really have enough money to take the pictures, and they did photography at the local university. So I didn't really need to go to university to study photography, but I went to the college to give me access to the dark rooms so I could continue to make the work. I mean, it's what happened. I was a kind of I don't want to sound kind of conceited, but I was in a completely kind of different league to the other students who were, a lot of them were just like very young and had just, you know.
It's because it started really early for me, that creative life. That was one I was wondering about you. I mean, when is a creative life, or when did you start imagining a life like you live now, or did you ever imagine that?
I was 25. I was DJing. I started DJing, and my mate who ran a club, was just like, you like music, do you want a DJ? I was like, do I get paid? They were like, if it's popular. So I was like, all right. And then like, I was a really like avid listener of music, like current music. I was constantly, you know, like it was exciting at the time. Like new bands are coming out every week.
When was this? What year would that be?
How old am I? 11 years ago. So, what are we now?
2020, so 2010 or something like that.
Yeah, but like, I realised real quick that it was a lot of like wankers on stage that looked bored and weren't really writing anything impressive or vital or vibrant or lifelike.
What kind of music were you DJing?
I was DJing a lot of post-punk, punk, indie. Like current music was just indie, really. It was just they called it indie, but like, you know, everything from 60s garage rock, post-punk, 70s, 80s, all around, anything kind of like the prototypical music of what was being released at that time. But gig going was just becoming more and more vapid, and like I just wanted to be a band full of life and kind of be not beautiful and but exciting to watch was my remit, I guess. I just wanted to inject a bit of life in. I just wanted to fill a gap that wasn't there for me, you know? Like, it was just boring.
And it was for you. That's interesting, because yeah, you weren't thinking about the market, the music market, or what's missing.
Nah, because it was dying, you know? Like, guitar music was dying. It was like, no one was buying it. We weren't selling out venues or anything for fucking 8 years. We didn't sell out a show. Yeah. Like, it wasn't about that. It was definitely for me. But like, at the same time, it wasn't for me because I wasn't good. So it's that frustration thing of like, I don't know, when you're about 5 or 6, or maybe younger, and someone says, draw a dog. And your brain's going, this is what a dog looks like, and your hand's going, this is what a dog looks like, and then you do that, and it doesn't look anything like the fucking dog in your head. It was like that for us for like 9 years, you know, until we started really speaking our own language. It takes a long time, you know. We were democratically writing, which means giving each other time to learn and be shit, and we were shit. So it wasn't for us for a long time. Mm. We were trying, and like the doing was the, you know, the music wasn't for us, but the doing was. Yeah,
that's good. Well, I know that like, when you were coming up, obviously a different decade, different time. But I mean, I remember you told me a story. You started really early. I mean, by making zines, right, blagging your way into gigs because you had a zine.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I started taking pictures when I realised if I had a camera, I could maybe get into shows, gigs for free. And I, because of my age being very young, I was kind of a bit taken under the wing of Mick Jones, who kind of took a liking to me and always, if I was around, would make sure that I, you know, got in and I could take some pictures, which was obviously very nice, you know, and that's the kind of friendship that I've maintained. So that's been good. But I mean, obviously they were kind of massive band, but I used to go and see bands, you know, like the Au Pairs and Delta 5 and, you know, the Birthday Party, a lot of kind of indie bands. When I, what was the kind of post-punk kind of bands, you know, I used to like.
I fucking love the Au Pairs, man. Obviously the other two as well. I just discovered the Au Pairs like literally about 4 months ago.
Yeah. They were so good live. And just the movement on stage, and they'd play with Delta 5, so you get to see both bands at the same time. And you know, they both had that kind of funky edge to them. The two Au Pairs albums are two of my favourite records, you know.
So. We're talking the early 80s?
We're talking the early 80s, 80, 81, 82.
And so you're a mid-teenager, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of 14, 15 in 1980. And I was going to all the, you know, you could get in. I mean, this is at a time when there was no IDing, right?
No.
If you looked old enough to go in somewhere, you could go in anywhere. You know, there was, and you could have a beer. No one gave a shit. I mean, it was like, you know, you couldn't, if when I was 14, I could go to the bar and I could buy half a lager or a pint of lager. I didn't drink that much, but I couldn't go. They wouldn't serve you a double vodka. You know, but you could go and you could have a beer and you could watch the band. I always, you know, had enough money for a beer and then, you know, or whatever. And I used to go to all the shows, all the gigs at the universities, you know, near where I lived. And then, because I lived on the outskirts of London in a place called Woking, which obviously has its own kind of history with the jam.
I realised you were well up.
Yeah, so I used to go and see them a lot. And obviously, you know, Simon Raymond, who was the bassist in the Cocteau Twins, also came from Woking.
Yeah.
And who's now the Bella Union guy, you know. So, and then there were the Guildford bands, you know, Crisis and the Vapors and the Stranglers, you know, which are all from that area, and all the gigs at Surrey University. And then, you know, punk night at the Lyceum on a Sunday evening.
So yeah. It's that proper suburban periphery thing that you come from. And you bubbling in Bristol when you were talking about your first forays into music, was it? Or was it?
Yeah. Like, yeah, I was at uni studying film, mid-20s, and I just discovered drugs and music and kind of scraped by the uni side and then just discovered, like, the city, the proper side of the city, as I think you normally do at uni, don't you? Fumble around the city when you go to university, going to all the fucking shit stains that, like, office workers enjoy, and then you, like, realise there's venues and fucking people that, you know, like the same drugs as you. So, yeah, it was great. I, like, suddenly discovered it properly.
It's a pretty big leap from just playing post-punk records to having a band and writing lyrics and writing music. But tell me about that a bit, because I mean, are you the driving force on the lyrics now? Or
yeah, always. Yeah.
Always have been, right?
Yeah, I wasn't going to sing anyone else's words. I thought, like, this is the only thing I got. Like, I wasn't good at singing, so I had to write. And my lyrics weren't that great to start with. I was very, like, you know, I don't know, thin, very thin. I got there eventually. Even now, I think it's a bit thin. But, it was like, It was just like giving up on the whole scene. Like, there's a scene. I don't want a scene. Do you know what I mean? I don't want there to be a scene. Like, the thing about Bristol is it's like, it's nowhere near the size of a big city. And that size, like, you know, it is a city. And the best thing about it is the people and a sense of, like, community that's not through drive, it's through, I don't know, it's like a weird joy to Bristol that's quite subdued. But that doesn't mean there's a lot of fight and a lot of competition and a lot of... So it's a balance of just not being a Bristol band, but really appreciating that Bristol, like, helped shape our philosophy.
Well, it's interesting, style. Really, because, like, Bristol's synonymous with, you know, I fucking hate the word trip hop and that, but there is this sort of thing
that crusty rave, isn't it?
Yeah. And the middle point there is tricky, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was very good friends with Tricky at one time. We used to hang out, and when he was living in New York, and then of course when he bought the infamous house in New Jersey, which he has no idea where it was, I was hanging out with him. I did a record cover for him, actually.
You know, oh, yeah?
Yeah, the album was called Products of the Environment, and it was Island never released it. Mm. Yeah, and it had all these, he recorded all these spoken word sessions with all the old London gangsters. I've forgotten.
Frankie Fraser.
Yeah,
and
all those people. And one of them had a pub down on the other side of the river, kind of Lewisham way.
And that'd be Frankie Former, probably.
Yes, a council estate pub, you know, one of those kind of 60s modern ones.
Self-made.
And they were all there on a Friday night, and they had on the wall in there this huge black and white photograph of London, and it was glazed, and then they all came in. I did the picture, and while I was doing the picture, a group shot of them all together, it was this enormous photograph fell on the food and smashed over all the food just from nowhere. And the looks on their face, and I thought, well, they're going to get rid of all the food, but they stood there and they picked the glass out of the food and they ate the food.
That's not being glassy, like, glassy, my volleyball, that's fuck all, mate.
Yeah, yeah. Some of them were like, you know, that Frankie whatever guy were really old, and they all went, what's that club near Old Street Roundabout? They used to have a swimming pool in where they used to do raves.
Oh, yeah, what's it called?
Yeah.
Flamingo? No. Whatever. I know the one you mean, yeah.
That rave club, Flamingo, they all went there to do pills afterwards. Yeah. Even the ones who were like in their 70s, they went there to take pills off. And they said, oh, do you want to come? I was like, no, I don't think so. That's not kind of what I'm about, yeah.
I met Frankie Fraser back in that day as well. I interviewed him for some stupid feature on Celebrity Gangsters. And he had that proper dead-eye sallow. He'd spent like the last 45 or the last 50 years in jail. He was had that death about him, you know.
Jesus. Yeah, I remember the name. Dave Courtney, maybe.
Dave Courtney's
the same. He may be the one who owned the pub.
Oh, right.
All very polite. And I did the pictures. I don't know where they are, actually. I must have them somewhere. And the following day, pictures of them all together appeared in the News of the Road World, and Tricky phoned me up and said, you've been selling photos to this. And I was like, no, there were other people with cameras, their families in the room. Mm. Yeah, it wasn't me that sold the pictures to the News of the World.
Wobbly and does News of the World splash.
Yeah, it's funny, yeah.
Anyway. But it's funny, like, this creative, I want to get back to this creative life then, because it feels like you've both, you're on a different sort of stages of a journey, as reality TV people call it. The journey of wherever you're going. Mm. But it's a strange one, isn't it? Because there are all these connections that emerge. And did you imagine that you'd be a lyricist working in the rock and roll industry with a third album out? I mean, what did you project that into the future? And is, you know, what did you imagine?
I've always had a plan. Like, I started off the band with a plan, which is to get good at writing music and be one of the best live bands on the planet. And we're still aiming for that. That's where I want to be. I want to be like Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds or a birthday party or Radiohead. We just, you know, we're on a journey, and like, it's my father, he just got up every morning to paint, and not to paint, sorry, to be a sculptor and to just be an artist. And like, I just realized, oh, I could be a musician. I loved it. I always always loved music. I just never thought I could be a musician. It's one of those things, like, you know, it's like speaking Japanese. I'd love to be able to speak Japanese. I'd love to be a musician by now. Yeah. And I realised, just like, you don't need an instrument, you just fucking shout at people. Mm. So ever since then, yeah, I've just kept my head down and worked on my craft until it doesn't become a craft anymore, it becomes an art. And I think it's just starting to transition to an art form now, starting to speak it properly. So that's why.
That must be an exciting thing to glimpse.
It's always exciting, even when you're shit and you know you're shit, that's exciting as well, you know? It's about having a realistic goal, you know? Like, next week, you know, let's try and sell out, or let's sell 50 tickets so we don't have to take money out of our own pocket for the fucking van we rent, or whatever. Yeah. And it's just set your challenges and be realistic about it, but think big. Like, you know, I want to be, you know, I want to be in love with what I do until I die, and that's it.
How about you and that? Because when you were setting out, I mean, I didn't know you until you were pretty still not established in that world, known as this reportage photographer. Did you glimpse some sort of career, or did it just develop and change out of all proportion? Because now, obviously, your creativity encompasses a lot of different things, the paintings that we see behind, which I'd like to ask you about at some point after this bit. But did you at that moment that Joe just recounted, when you might have glimpsed craft turn into art? Because that I think that is an exciting moment, and I wonder if you experienced that.
I think, you know, I've always been fairly kind of confident about what I do, and then I'm happy to fail, and I'm happy to fail in public if that is going to enable me to continue to get somewhere else. And I'm always kind of revising what the challenge is. Are and I'm kind of revising where I want to go with it, and in that, it keeps everything kind of exciting. If there's a point, of kind of inertia where you've got to the point where you're established and you're making work, and if you keep going in that vein, then you can make a good living from it. And I've seen this happen to a lot of my contemporaries, people I was, you know, I kind of knew when I was young, and they've kind of stagnated because of that. And their work is kind of ultimately boring, and they're kind of waiting now to be kind of rediscovered again for their kind of second push later on. Mm. Whereas a very few people I know who've kind of kept kind of trying to change things and keep it dynamic. And that for me has always been the kind of drive. I'm excited every day to get up and make work again, because I'm always moving the goalposts.
Mm. Mm. It's all about those goalposts. It strikes me as well, and I feel there's a common thread here as well. Not like I'm trying to look at these false relationships, but I think it's true in saying that I'm inspired by artists that have this element, is that in something that you do, there is a sort of social function there. There's something that's related to contemporary society that comments upon it, sometimes explicitly, sometimes less so. But certainly, a lot of your photographic work is directly, you know, kind of, there's an aesthetic there, of course, but it's making a social commentary. Does that help it keep it fresh? Because I know, obviously, your lyrics are very much in that vein. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely, especially in this country where we've got this kind of regression going on. It's not easy, it's not difficult to be kind of politicised and kind of want to comment on it, especially, you know, at the moment. I mean, but that never really changes, you know. I'm 55, and for except for a kind of short period when I was, you know, a small child and the Tony Blair years, it's been the Tories all the way,
mm-hmm.
all of my life. Yeah, I mean, you know, and they're not easy to dislike, are they, really? I mean, they certainly like give you lots of opportunity to be angry, really. I don't know if you find that.
Yeah, I mean, like, I find now, like, yeah, I mean, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, like, music and, no, just art, you know, music and art, well, art, full stop, really, is political, isn't it? If you're aware of where you are in life, if you're in any way leaning towards an existential overview where you're at, that's a political thing. Unless somehow you're fucking, like, you've got your own state that you're not telling anyone about. So, you know, art is about exploring where you are in the world and what the world means to you, and giving it to other people as a point of reference, really, to enjoy, to find ugly, to talk about, to explore, to make your own version of, to dance with, to fuck with, whatever it is. It's just an exchange of the world in your little window for a split second. And, like, to ignore, it's always political. Buying milk's political, really. Choose where you buy milk, if you think about it enough. Mm. I'm on the explicitly kind of, ooh, like, cartoon-like political, because I found that I wanted to cut through it. And, like, I am from the birth, when I started voting, was the birth of neoliberalism, which is the birth of Uber bullshit, the mega liars, the real cunts, the Cheshire Cat fucking drone bombing scumbag cunts, a lot of them, you know, with branding in front of it. So it's like, I want to use that kind of weird, black and white, sinister, globalised, fucking everyone's happy, nursery rhyme, socialism, and fuck with it and sing about it. But I think, you know, my generation, probably every generation, but my generation, the problem is, it's not like I am clearly on. I find myself as far left leaning as I've ever been, but I'm just as fucked off with the left as I am with the right now, because of the internet, because of pious keyboard cunts.
Mm.
But not as much. I still despise the right a lot more, or what the right stand for. But like, I find myself battling on a surface level with the left as much because they're just full of shit. Mm. There's a lot of bullshit to cut through. Yeah. But obviously, I am vehemently fighting against the right ideologically anyway. Mm. You know, but yeah, it's my interest. But it's just a very bizarre time to be alive politically, I think.
And as a lyricist with a band that's got good platform now, you can say explicit things, right? You can be explicit, and you've got an audience.
We can create a mob finally. No, you mean that.
I know you're not fucking about when you say that.
No,
right?
I don't want to create a mob. The idea of creating a mob to me is a real responsibility. I don't want that. I don't want that. It's too much. But you know, an audience, yeah, definitely. We've got a good audience, and we always just wanted to spark conversation, just a level of consciousness beyond what I was getting when I was going to gigs. But it's all personal. It's not party political. It is all personal political. It's all about where you stand in the world and then who you vote for after it. It's not up to me, but it's up to me to try and start a conversation about where you think you feel or you are in the world and what you're up to.
It's interesting because, so your living room pictures, for example, right, there's something about, you make an image of a working class family at a certain place in a certain time, and there's a beauty to it, there's an aesthetic element to it, in the same way that a lyric can be beautiful or a riff can be brilliant, or a drum solo or whatever can be beautiful, but it has an impact. Is it less direct when it's a photograph? When you're making that work, for example, is it the personal politic that you're expressing through that lens, that you're seeing through that lens?
Well, I certainly, you know, when I was making that work or making any of the work that I've made, I enjoy it. And kind of what I see in the work is not necessarily what other people see. I also think that, you know, the work that I make often is quite kind of ugly and brutal when I make it to most people. But ultimately, it's the ugly and brutal work that survives. And a good analogy is the kind of music business. If you kind of think about the early 80s, the bands that the major labels were promoting them at that period, who knows who any of them are now? Mm. But all the indie bands, like, you know, the ones we were just talking about, like, you know, there's Joy Division, whatever, and, you know, Echo and the Bunnymen, everyone's interested in those bands. You speak to young people, they're interested in those bands. I know Echo and the Bunnymen were a major label band, but they started on an indie. But, you know, so if you make things that you think are kind of cutting edge and maybe are a bit too hard for the masses, maybe when they're made, but with time that will change. I've kind of always stuck to that principle, and people kind of come round to what I do kind of often years after I've made it. I'm not particularly worried. I kind of just keep on going and kind of find ways to survive. And ultimately, you know, I make the work for me, and I make the work because I enjoy making the work. And if other people can engage with it, then that's great. But if they don't, then I'm not kind of worried about it too much.
It's funny that about how the work ages differently with time and matures, isn't it? So for example, on the way up, I was listening to Six Music and they played that Selector tune, Too Much Pressure. Mm. I remember at the time thinking that it was a bit light and half-assed, but I'm belting up the motorway and it's on a really good sound system in my motor, and it's a digital file that's really big and booming, and it sounds completely different, and it sounds punky as well as it's got that ska drive to it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's funny, and you can say that with, like, literally I read Catch 22. About 30 years after I first read it, and it's a completely different book. And it's interesting, and you mentioned, like, The Clash, for example. I didn't really dig The Clash. To me, at the time, it sounded a bit light. It sounded quite sort of punk light. And then you listen to it now, and now I can get it. I mean, did you have that experience with music? And how do you think your music's going to be? How is it going to wither? Is it going to wither on a vine or fruit again? It was a stupid question.
Well, no, what I'd like is to just grow with it. Like, our albums just become more fluent as we go along, definitely. So age-wise, I think people will appreciate, especially in what you're saying about about like the harder bands or the grittier bands or the basically the bands that weren't very popular at the time suddenly being like, you know, you can get their t-shirt in H&M, like Joy Division, you know, like, I think our first album will be the most popular album in years to come. Well, out of the two that are out at the moment, I think our third album is our best album, artistically speaking. And I think our second was the most friendly. So like, which is an interesting thing. I've thought about how our music would age just because it's an interesting point. But like, for me, like things like putting things in context, like Public Enemy, for example, or Fun Boy 3, or like songs that I enjoy, Ghost Town is another example. Songs that just, you know, when you realise what they're about and what it meant to people at the time.
The second Fun Boy 3 album, Waiting, the David Byrne produced one, is one of the best records I've ever heard. I mean, that album is absolutely crazy. It's so good. Yeah. Mm. I mean, I listened to it all the time when it came out in 84 or whatever, and I still listen to it now.
So again, but especially with Breaking Up for me was like a disaster. Yeah. I couldn't bear to listen to Fun Boy 3.
Fucking sick.
No, but I'll have to check that again. I haven't listened to it.
I envy that. You get to listen to the album. It's like, that's it. Things just, you know, for me, I wasn't around. My dad was an artist and then became an art teacher in Factory Right Britain to make some money, and then went back to just being an artist. And like, would talk to me about those times, and it makes things a lot more fascinating.
Yeah. Is your dad in Newport?
He studied in Newport, when Joe Strummer was there.
Did he teach at Newport?
No, he taught at Caldecott.
I don't know where that is.
Just outside, it's in South Wales.
Oh, right.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Like he went to Glasgow Art School in the old Macintosh building and then
Newport
stayed in Wales.
Newport's one of those fascinating places. It's much maligned. It's got like this crystal of kind of demonisation and kind of like the white working class and the marginality of that, right?
Yeah, it's the butt. It's like, you know, the Skoda of towns, like, you know, it's the butt of a lot of jokes. You go there's not a lot to laugh about, and a piece of
the Goldie looking chain came from there.
Yeah, exactly. That was a whole start of holding.
People often sing the Newport song they want to say I was born there, but like, as your work can like, there's nothing funny about Thatcher's nightmare. There's not. But the people there are fucking amazing. South Walians, you know, like you go
the
to
humour in Newport's fucking just
it's be- it's, on, they're beautiful people, and like, you know,
any of those places.
To it. It's all stereotypical, but it's true.
Of those places where it was completely dominated by steel industry, pubs on every corner, and then within about 8 years, they're all gone. And what you've got is they've still got all the pubs, and you've got the passport office, that's it. Mm-hmm. Right in the DVLA or whatever it is. And so
don't they make the money there still? Isn't the coin, mint there?
I don't know. Royal Mint?
Yes.
Really?
I thought it was. I might be wrong. Somewhere in South Wales.
Mm, for sure. Yeah, I wouldn't know. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, now it's, like, you know, dereliction, a couple of cash for gold shops, some Chazzers. Mm. It's fucking bleak.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's a weird thing. Like, there's a lot of things that like I've noticed recently about high street cultures. High streets are all fucked. Not that I was, you know, if they weren't all fucked, it wasn't like I'd spend all my time on the high street.
I was going to say, I can't imagine you going to H&M.
No, don't get me wrong. I do think about what I wear. I'm not going to pretend I don't care about how I look. I'm not going to fucking be one of those cunts, but like, I wouldn't spend it, but there's a thing for it. There's an importance to it. And like, but what I've found now is this weird, like, conveyor belt of consumerism where like they will go to those like retail parks and shit like that. I just find it really weird. I think it's really weird. It's a lack of, I guess, personality, independent shops, independent whatever. But it's just a weird fucking country, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm just looking at it like Britain is just a strange place.
The drop in prices of everything has allowed people to still keep consuming large amounts of things on less and less money as everything's got cheaper and cheaper. Mm. You know, you can go to Primark or whatever and you can like buy shitloads of clothes for what you used to be able to buy one item for. Mm. But then, you know, consequently, it's made in Bangladesh and the buildings fall down. Yeah. But it does. People want to consume the kind of fast fashion thing. It's kind of where that goes from here, I don't know. Whether it'll be back in 2 or 3 years' time, once everyone's forgotten COVID, I'm not sure. But the thing with the clothes factories in Leicester, when they were kind of turning a blind eye to it, happening here, weren't they?
I'd love to speak to like an.
Don't mind if I snap a little way, just for me, right?
No, it's fine.
It's all right.
It's a good camera, that.
Yeah, it's a bit fucked.
I'd love to speak to an economist about where they think this is all headed, properly. Like, because you can make guesses about what, but like for me, it's like fucking. Surely this has all got to collapse at some point. Like just walking around London and seeing all these empty buildings that like, you know, no one can afford to live in that are occupied, seemingly, by
I think it's actually the suburbs though that are coming back, right? So I cycle around London, you go through the centre and it's all dead, and you go out to the high streets, the restaurants are buzzing, there's lots of people. And I feel like you might get this weird inversion going on, I think, that might save things.
But yeah, I mean, I've seen that, obviously, you know, when I was a kid, you know, we lived in Woking and it's 15 minutes to Waterloo, and my father worked near Oxford Circus. And, you know, that's what everyone did, you know. And then, of course, you know, I moved into town. I've lived in Tower Hamlets and Hackney since I was a student, you know, in the mid to late 1980s. And the idea now that people are now going to go back to the suburbs, I'm not so sure. Eventually, it will happen for a while, but people don't want to travel. They don't want to commute anymore. Whether people can work at home, but whether working at home means you're well off enough to live in a large house and have an office, or whether you're 30-somethings in a cramped flat and you're all sitting there with your laptops on your desk and the internet's going down, do they really want to do that? I don't think so, you know?
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? It's just like the. I'd just love to see a shift in that perspective of what is important, like what a working week should look like for mentally well people, and what that would do, like, you know, a mentally well worker is a lot better worker than someone who's fucking knackered and resentful.
Isn't that one of the urges? 4 day
week would be good, I think, that they should do that. Yeah, people can choose if they do Fridays or Mondays.
Isn't that one of the urges of being an artist, right? That you can set your own agenda and you can't, you know, you're not answering to anyone.
Depends who you talk to. There's a lot, like, I've got loads of mates who haven't got a boss but are fucked. You know, like.
Well, for me, I feel like. I'm definitely outside the premises of normal life. I mean, I'm able to exist, make my work, and I interface with society. But whether I'm here or I'm in New York, I'm not really kind of involved very much. I'm lucky enough that I'm kind of financially secure enough to be able to do that, I think, you know. Yeah. But when I was in my 20s and in my 30s, everything was much cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
So even though I wasn't kind of so successful with my work, I had a huge studio on Brick Lane that was £50 a month between five or six, ten pounds each for a whole, and it came with heating and, you know, and we could live there if we wanted to, but, you know, I didn't bother living there. I was able to, you know, buy a house for 40 grand. You know, all this kind of thing. And then you could live really cheaply and just make work. You know, throw the odd kind of rave party to raise some money when you needed a bit of extra cash.
Mm.
You can't do that now.
No.
They've kind of made everything really, really expensive. Mm. Everything costs money. You know, the kind of, what's the name of the American comedian, the one who died of the heart attack in 91?
It was like Bill Hicks.
Bill Hicks, yeah. They put the fucking dollar sign on everything, you know. And that's happened now. Everything costs money. The only thing here that they haven't done yet is the NHS, but, you know, if they continue.
Yeah, get it, aren't they?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So I want to talk about the work again for a bit.
Yes.
Anaglypta. Is that, am I pronouncing it right?
No, Anaglypta.
Anaglypta, it's not, yes. Anaglypta.
No, right. No.
For you, is this some sort of watershed piece, you know? Does it mean a transition more towards your painting work, or
well, what's happened is, especially over the last 10 years as I've got older, I've painted more and more. I still take photos, but when I was living in Jerusalem and I needed to, because I have been painting, I've had painting shows since the 1990s, but when I was living in Jerusalem, I was painting every day, and I moved to Jerusalem in 2007, and that was the kind of, since then it's been every day, and I now got to the point where the painting is very resolved and is kind of going places, but I have this huge backlog of photography, and I've been very fortunate to meet Johnny Liu, the designer who runs Johnny Liu Studios, and we have a kind of program to kind of work through my backlog of photography. It doesn't mean that I'm not going to take any more pictures, but I'm lucky enough that I don't do anything else other than make art. I don't have a job, I don't teach, you know. Therefore, I find that I have enough, because I'm a kind of workaholic, I have enough time to make pictures and spend all day painting. So, I mean, I'm mainly making photographs now, kind of individual works taken with a large format camera, and each subject is different. And so I only need to maybe make 10 or 12 a year. And then I've got the camera in my pocket when I'm moving around and I'm making the kind of visual diary pictures anyway. Not going to stop. So I can kind of dedicate myself 6.5 days a week to painting.
Tell me about the Hackney Riviera. I don't know if you've seen it, Joe. Beautiful, like you shot it. Tell me about it. It was like last couple of years ago.
I'll give you one before you leave.
Amazing set of pictures shot down on the on Hackney Marshes, which is now really popular, a swimming spot along the River Lee. But you captured this. Those are painterly images, right?
Yes, they're very beautifully comfortable, like.
Yeah, exactly. They're almost like they're beautiful. And as you said before, you haven't really concentrated on obvious beauty before, right?
No, but the kids, you know, my older son and his mates, you know, heard about this kind of swimming spot, and it was during the kind of beautiful summer of 2018 when it was really hot. England were doing well in the football, and suddenly this kind of swimming spot appeared from nowhere on the river around here. And for a moment, for a couple of months, it was enough people to make it kind of interesting, but it wasn't really crowded. And then what's happened now is that Hackney Council have cleared the sides of
all the undergrowth.
All the undergrowth.
Agent Orange.
From the sides of the river. And now it's become this kind of rave in the river spot. And it's kind of something completely different.
Yeah.
But so my pictures just concentrate on that 1 month period during the football. Mm. And it's about a moment. Mm. It's not about necessarily that spot. It's about this moment where it was
hot like it was in the hot summer of 1976.
Yeah.
And you could just feel that it was just a vintage summer and just a really kind of nice moment in time. So I just, for that month, I concentrated on taking photographs again. Solidly, and I made the book.
It's funny, when I heard about it, I caught wind of it before you published it. I thought, oh, Wappleton does Ackney Marshes. Oh, it's going to be all grim and, you know, like, I don't know, sort of shopping trolleys in the river and that. But what emerged is like, wow, it's just absolute beautiful London, which is very rarely captured, very difficult to capture. And I thought that was interesting. So what do you think about, let's talk about the beauty in what you do, because my opinion of your music is that there's this underlying engine of groove to it that then pushes it away from a lot of the other heavy music that I've listened to and changes it somewhere, and then you put the lyrics within that groove and it's transformative somewhere.
I mean, I grew up on hip hop and stuff, personally. And our guitarist, the other guy, writes a lot of stuff with me. Like minimal techno and stuff like that. And like other shit. But like, my main influence is hip hop and jungle and stuff. But I think there's a sense of like Britishness in it that's from something motoric. That the underlying thing is the same thing that you get in Echo and the Bunnymen. Really, there's a layer of flamboyance at the top of that band, right? But underneath is still this like motoric thing. And you look at like mid-century modernism, anything that like is rife in this country, it's all motoric. It's quite a motoric, keep your chin down and get shit done kind of country. And I think it's just in there. I think also something ugly about the mechanism of our music, which is what I'm more interested in. The same reason why I'm more interested in your style of photography and like, you know, Billingham or Larry Clark or even stuff. It's like, for me, the most interesting, beautiful people are the broken. And like, it's not the flamboyant, you know. I've never empathized with a disco tune. Not to say that disco isn't fucking amazing. And there's a drive in that, but for me, there's nothing about it that grabs me. It's about like, I don't know, you know. I'm not from the ghetto or anything, but it's just the realism, you know. I like Mike Lee. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're trying to bring out, the mundaneity of daily life to highlight the beauty of people.
But there is a theatricality about your shows. I mean, you know, you go over the top, don't you? And you under, you know, what could be perceived as quite a macho world, you undermine that. You talk about, the lyrics talk about that, you know, toxic masculinity. It's kind of a hint at it, and it kind of undermines things. Do you think,
in a very macho way?
Kind of.
I mean, I think, you know, it's the same as what fucking David Byrne says in his book, How Music Works. Yeah. It's like, it is a theatre, but like my theatre is me. Like if I'm in a bad mood, I just make sure my mascara is longer so you can see I'm in a bad mood at the back of the room. I'm not going to lie and pretend everything's good that day. But if I'm happy, I'm extra happy. If I'm sad, I'm extra sad. It's just, it's a giving. Yeah. So you want a dialogue with an audience, you've got to give them something first so they don't fuck you.
That's
off.
A good point. I think that's really important in art, all kind of art, and to leave nothing in the dressing room, right? Put it all out there. And I feel like there's something that you've done as well. Like it does feel quite, like you're saying, you said earlier that you're not afraid to fall on your ass in public.
Mm.
That's important, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah, because everything now is about kind of creating the perfect this and the perfect that. And especially, you know, the way that the art world is commodified now, that people are producing objects to be sold, or they were until COVID, sold at art fairs and transported around quickly and easy. And then you've got this whole kind of level of people who have come up who are art fair artists, and they make commodity items to be sold at art fairs. And everything is really slick. Everything looks slick. Everything is beautifully made. You go into galleries in New York and everything is perfect. and it's just terrible. Yeah. And you just, you know, it was like the kind of the art that was made in the colonial period at the end of the 19th century, that all of this work's all been forgotten now. You know, it's just trash. And I just feel that that's where we're at again, you know, and it's all kind of sped up. And, you know, there's just so much bollocks being made that I'm trying to kind of stay out of that and just kind of continue with my own thing. And I kind of, but somehow I kind of managed to do it without having to really interface too much with that world.
Which is nice, right?
Yes.
I believe all of us sitting around the table were fathers. Am I right?
Yeah.
How do you think becoming a father has impacted what you do and how you do it?
I mean, I care much, much less about what other people think of me now. Because I've got one person that I really fucking got to work for and be better at. Like, looking after myself so that, like, better as in, like, mental health and physical health for me at the moment is like, oh, you know, like, suddenly sobriety had a different thing. It's like, well, you know, I can't be late for picking my daughter up or things like that. Just, it sounds just really basic, but what it means is you have a self-preservation where you're like, actually, all those people that are obsessing about making people feel shit about themselves, just meaningless cunts. And that what you do is beautiful and important. Because that's what you'd say to your daughter or your son, exactly, right? You wouldn't be like, no, your pictures aren't good enough. You can't put it on the fridge. You go, yeah, you're trying, it's beautiful, you're a beautiful thing. Amazing, crack on. You encourage the people you love. You realise you've got to encourage yourself and fuck them off.
Yeah. Nick?
Yeah, I think that's what, you know, pretty true. You're definitely going to, you have to think about keeping yourself healthier. Certainly brought about some lifestyle changes for me. You know, when I first had children in my 30s, late 30s, so... you know, that's all been positive, you know, and then kind of leads you back as they get older into other things creatively. Like my oldest son is really into hip hop, and you know, I wasn't skateboarding every day for a number of years until he was, you know, down at Mile End, and so I was there all the time. So that was good for me too, till I didn't destroy my knee again. But anyway. But yeah,
I found out, you know, like that whole thing about when you become a father, it's like, oh, I'm going to get a proper job now, right? I always thought that was bullshit, because if you're going to all of a sudden fucking change everything about yourself, what sort of a father are you going to be?
Yeah, I would have, because obviously, I, you know, like you mentioned already, I'm lucky enough to have a platform in which COVID-19 isn't this fucking black wall of despair. Like, you know, our audience have kept us afloat and supported us throughout this, which is great. But if I had a kid, I wouldn't just suddenly stop making music. I'd be like, now I've got to get a office. I'm just going to say office job, because I don't even know what that would look like. But it's just not, it's not in my I learned from my father, you know? Like, well, and my mum, who was in an office job and drank herself to death. Like, that's not success to me. No, she was much more well off monetarily than my father.
Yeah.
But she was suicidally alcoholic because of her levels of stress and want to give me a better life, but thinking that a better life means money.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I'm looking into a lot of parenting stuff now. I'm reading Philippa Perry's book and stuff like that on attachment parenting. Yeah. And it's like, there's nothing more you can give your child than your attention, and your love, and your, like, just engaging with them more than just, you know, not someone to deal with, but to be with and just engage with and have a fucking have interaction with on a day, you know, which is something my mum did when we were in the same room together. She was an amazing woman, amazing friend of mine, and an amazing strong mother, but she sacrificed 90% of our life together for a better, you know, monetarily better.
It's a story echoes through so many people's lives, right? About, you know, that commitment to just getting the bigger house and the bigger commuting, getting away from everyone, whereas you realise that the reality was right on your doorstep. But tell me, how does the mid-century dream of the rock and roll life, how does that articulate with how you are now?
I've never fucking, like for me, I'm like, what I want to do is be able to do this until I can't make music anymore. So like, and realistically, you get better at making music. More people want to see you. Even if you make the same kind of level of music, the longer you play, the more likely you are to play bigger rooms because more people will have heard of you, unless you're shit, or you know, or you're not, people aren't talking about you. Over time, the rooms will grow a little bit, at least. So like, as long as I can just do this for as long as I'm breathing, I'm all right, you know? But I don't know, man. Like, I was brought up to not, like, you know, I did a lot of drugs and like, I was very wasteful in that sense of the word. I wasted a lot of time and had a lot of bullshit conversations, got myself in some really dark places in my life. That's about as bullshit that side of the world as I went. And that was before we were popular. I'm just glad that I fucking straightened up before I had the opportunity to just take whatever I fucking wanted. And you know, I can now. I could take advantage of it in a really destructive way and I wouldn't. So I'm lucky, really. But all that side of it, I mean, like, you know, like, it's that Spinal Tap thing. I think, like, I'd want someone to fucking hang me if I turned out like some of those.
But it's something, you know, when you look at an Idols gig, there's a lot of fucking energy there. And you must be popping, when you come off stage like that, you must be fucking in a place that I can only imagine, never have done it myself. Those things are real, you know, the things that do are the cliches. How do you come down from that? Like, I'm sure you've got techniques and it's a fucking long conversation, but those things are real, aren't they? They don't just disappear because you change an attitude. It must be quite a tough thing to negotiate.
I mean, it's just, realistically, I think because it's not the situation that alleviates. We fucking make it. We give, like, it's a higher energy show, right?
Yeah.
So we're knackered afterwards.
Yeah.
The come down is just like, we need to rest and enjoy it. I have a few beers after the show, you know, like whatever it is, you know, like you used to just get fucked up every night on tour. Mm. Just, you know, drink and do drugs for 3 months. Mm. I haven't done that for years because I'd die. It's knackering. Just like we just did at Abbey Road Studios, like 3 live sessions and like yesterday. And I was just like, fucked after it, knackered. I forgot how tiring it is.
And is that a mixture of the actual performative, just the physical exhaustion of it, or the tension, the nervousness, it's the creative balance? Is it a whole mixture?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's adrenaline and like, really, I fucking love it. I love it. I love it. You know, I cry a lot at shows. I cry because you're just in it and it feels physically like ecstasy.
It's a dream though, right? I mean, you started out with like engaging with music. That, do you, have you imagined what it, I mean, I've countless times.
Well, I've been to Abbey Road Studios a few times. I have my friend, John Coxon, who was Spring Hill Jack and is the guitarist in Spiritualized, and he has an improv label called Treader, and I've been in that room with him where the Beatles used to record, you know, and watched him do kind of improvised sessions. It's a kind of magical space, you know, there. So I can,
But see, I'm thinking about like the quench of the creative thirst. I mean, you're drained, right? You're off stage. That must be must feel like you're sated for a bit.
I don't know, like, because I also want to, like, you know, I do all of our artwork and I want to write more and I want to design shirts, hopefully not in some, get them made in some fucking, but you know, like, you know, I want to make films and I want to write screenplays and I want to, like, I just think it's just like, some people get up in the morning and they want to, they're not a spectator of life, they want to be part of the world and do something. Some people are spectators and that's great.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's not, for me, like, the show is amazing.
Yeah.
It's not the end for me.
No, no, no.
It's like, there's no fear of it ending. I'm always going to make something.
Yeah.
So it's fine.
So when you get when you get a book back from press then, do you get that sense of creative, like, it's like the snooker player pots a hole, you know, no. The red goes into the corner. Does it feel like that?
No, I mean, for me, the kind of the moments I really like are when I'm making the work or after I've made the work. So if I've, say, if I'm taking a picture, and I just kind of instinctively know if it's good, mm-hmm. and I kind of feel good, and maybe I'll go and have a beer. Or if I'm painting, I finish a painting and I know it's a good one. Or I'm in the studio and I'm painting and I have a kind of breakthrough, because often you're painting and you could be painting for months and they're just shit and you're trying some... to go yeah. somewhere new, and then you get a breakthrough, and that for me is the kind of moments that I live for. I think, obviously, you know, there are other moments. You know, I've had one person show at the Tate, of course. You're at the opening and you're in the fucking Tate and it's yeah. your show. Mm, and you yeah. do feel a little bit then that, like, yeah, maybe, you know, there's something there, and you feel a little bit of kind of proud in the moment, and then what's, you know, you wake up the next morning and you just think, oh my God. And then you just want it to go away. It's kind of...
really?
Yeah.
How so?
Well, I much prefer having shows in places where I don't live, because I can... you get very depressed afterwards.
Yeah.
And if you can leave that place, then the depression goes sooner.
I see. Right.
Yeah,
okay.
So if I have a show in London, I'm in London, I have a show in New York, I'm in New York, I just want to go away somewhere,
yeah,
and maybe come back towards the end, but that's not always it's possible.
A funny thing, isn't it, that, like, because it's kind of like what I'm getting from what you're saying is that when you're making the art,
yes.
so like really it's like your that's your part in the world, isn't it, when you're making it. It's like the gratification is in being a part of your world that you're making. It's like playing live, painting. That's us making, that's us being. The gratification, what other people will think, is like the potting of the red ball or whatever. That's, you don't score the goal. It's like, it's being part of the world and making something beautiful. The making is, that's the bit. That's the bit. And there's no gratification after it. You just make something else. Do you know what I'm saying?
Process.
Yeah.
That's, process, that's, not destination.
Yeah. Because the destination is death.
Exactly.
And that's where there's a sense of depression after it. If that's, you feel that's all you have. Like bands that set themselves goal. Abbey Road, that's it. That's it. It's like, it doesn't work like that. For me, I'm just, album four. That's my, in my mind now, the whole time for the last 6 months, album four, that's all I think about. In terms of gratification. It's not, well, we've played Abbey Road. Because then I would be like, strap me up. I've done Abbey Road now. Mm. I've played Glastonbury, I've done this. Yeah. It's like, they're not the gratification. It's about making that fucking painting or making that song where you're like in it going, this is fucking amazing.
Mm.
Fluency, you know.
So I want to talk about latest projects and new projects. I feel like we're talking for a long time now. How long are we going for?
Is this what you're doing at the moment?
Yeah, let's talk about that. Based on Russian constructivism, these paintings, kind of where the world is at now. They're a kind of semi-abstract modernist paintings, I guess you would describe them. I've been looking a lot at Russian art from 100 years ago during the kind of the end of the beginning of the Soviet Union and of course the last pandemic, and then I kind of started to make these paintings that kind of have these kind of loose connections to Malevich and suprematism and Russian constructivism. That also kind of feed into music, because a lot of the images from that kind of period were used as a cover art for a lot of post-punk records from the early 80s. You know, the Raincoats used a lot of Malevich, and also, you know, Squiddy Politti and whatever. Yeah. So all these kind of things fed back into these paintings that then have these kind of weird Russian-y, Scandi kind of titles, but in fact are just northern slang that comes from my granddad and my uncle.
That's great.
Like Sumat, which is, you know, something, is one of them. And then, what was I going to say? Something else about them. But
I was wondering about that, you know, that constructivist thing in the early 80s and that. With I made a connection. I thought it was just straight, like, leftist politics, right?
Yeah.
But you think it was more than that? Was it any deeper than that? That why that those images were used on
those
albums?
Yeah, I think
that I thought it was, like, you know, Red Wedge and all that, and, you know.
I think a lot of that art, a lot of it hadn't been seen until the kind of late 70s, early 80s, when basically a lot of it was hidden away in Russia, and a lot of people hadn't seen a lot of it. And slowly historians were being allowed into the Soviet Union, and Jewish emigres were leaving the Soviet Union and being allowed to go to Israel. And of course, I'm Jewish, and I'm a German Jew, but, you know, even then, there was a point where my family would have migrated from Russia to Germany and Switzerland. But so there's and a lot of the artists are Jewish, and so I wasn't really particularly interested in any of this till I found myself living in Jerusalem.
Yeah,
and then that's one way to engage with your Judaism. Yeah, go to the Holy Mount of Zion.
Obviously, you know, I'm an atheist, so, you know, things that Jewish people have done interest me more than the actual religion itself. But obviously, there are a lot of things within the religion that are interesting, kind of historically. But, you know, and this is one of the things about Judaism that interests me, is that you can give up being a Catholic, you can give up being a Protestant, you can't give up being a Jew, even if you're not religious. Yeah. It's just like you are a Jew.
Joe, album 4, you said you were already thinking about it.
Yeah.
What's happening? what's the process with you guys? I mean, is it, do you book like a target date in the studio and then work towards that?
Well, not normally, but we set ourselves a date this time because of COVID and the fact that we've, like, been gifted loads of time. Because we're getting, you know, we're paying ourselves a wage. We're like, fucking, right, we're not touring, let's get another album done. So we booked ourselves in the studio in February. It's fucking terrifying because we haven't finished the song yet. But we always do the same thing. Just start. I'll come up with a title for the album and the artwork and a concept of what we're writing around.
Oh, so each album's a concept album. You start.
Artistic direction, basically, so that the guys, we're all on the same page. Because otherwise, you know, we spent a long time trying to figure out how to do that. Yeah. And the best way is to be like, you know, give ourselves a palette that we all work towards. Yeah. Just stay within the lines, like, a bit. Yeah. And, you know, it just means we work quicker together if we know what the theme is. So Ultra Mono was started with the phrase Ultra Mono that I came up with, and the idea about it. Momentary acceptance of the self, mindfulness, and a drive with self-assurance. You know, just believe in yourself and move forward. And how would that sound? Where do you steal that from? You know, what music encompasses that sense of self-awareness and a holistic self, being in the now. You know.
And the album drops the end of this month, right?
Yes.
And what does that mean?
September.
What does that mean these days? I'm not a music journalist. What's the process of an album dropping these days? Is it because it's so different from what it once was, right?
If you sell enough records, you can get to number one if you give a shit about stuff like that. I mean, it means a lot less.
Yeah.
People not buying records, you know. But
there's a non-linear kind of thing with records now.
Mm.
Like, kids will pick up things from the past, won't they? In a way that when I was a kid, it was just what was new and was coming out now.
Mm.
Whereas my 15-year-old son, he likes, like, the latest grime, but he likes 90s hip-hop.
Mm.
But I wasn't listening. When in 1980, I wasn't listening to anything from 1965. I mean, you know, that wasn't, or 1950 or something, or whatever. Yeah. That, you know.
That well, that's what I think is interesting with a contemporary band like yourselves. You have got this big audience. I get the feeling you have, right? Mm-hmm. They measure that. I mean, I know, you know, your PR people tell me that, you know, the album's got a load of pre-sales. How do you think that audience has caught on to what you're doing and is digging you so much?
We built ourselves on word of mouth. That's why it took us 11 years, like, because we just went out and played like it was our last show ever, every night, because no other band was doing that at the time. I never saw a band that fucking looked like they were playing for their lives. And I wanted that because I heard stories about bands that were. I've heard stories about the birthday party. I'm like, where the fuck, where are they? Where the fuck's my birthday party?
The birthday party were amazing live. He was like, the way that he moved across the stage, and then the two guitarists used to kind of split, and then Tracy Pugh, the first bassist, used to dress like a cowboy. And I remember, and he just stand there with those leather trousers on. And the thing I remember at the time that really got me is he had a moustache. I was like, you can't be in a punk band with a moustache. You can't, why has he got a moustache?
I love it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's just, I don't know. We just went out and just played because we wanted to play. And that's how we built our audience. Because, you know, it was mainly 35 to 65 year old men going, I haven't seen a band do this for fucking ages. I'm really grateful you are doing it.
I feel like you've got a lot of young'uns that dig it though as well. It's not
yeah,
just
I mean,
that,
at right? the start, oh, when, right, we, yeah, when yeah. we were starting out, our bread and butter were people that missed bands that gave a shit about playing live.
I think there's a massive first set, and I think that's the Huck audience is all about that as well, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you want a bit, someone that's got something to fucking say, and that can still, and you can still groove to, and you can still get, you know, that groove is really important, and the beauty is still part of it. You know, right? We've talked for ages. I'm just going to ask one more question. If you had to take, it's a bit of a desert island disc thing I do.
Great.
Bit corny.
I like this shit.
One book, first of all. If you had to take one into your coffin, what would the book be?
Giovanni's Room.
James Baldwin.
Mm.
You're the second person this month has said that.
Really? Well, it's probably because of the Black Lives Matter stuff.
Probably, yeah.
That he's been put back into people's consciousness, or that they read it for the first time. But that's my favourite book, I think.
Yeah.
There's a scene where he's writing about falling in love with the guy, and they've been out all night in Paris, and they've managed to find a bar at like 5 in the morning, and he's just falling in, like watching him fuck around with, like, the guy he's falling in love with, Giovanni, is just prancing around the bar, and like he's just admiring.
I think I know the scene.
The character, about, and it's just a really lovely scene.
I haven't read it for a long time. Nick, great book. Your book,
Mervyn Peake's The Gormenghast Trilogy, or as my mother calls it, Gormenghastly. You like that book, Gormenghastly? But I mean, Mervyn Peake was a war artist in the Second World War, and he was. He went into Auschwitz with the troops and made those drawings, and he was so horrified that it spurred him on to write the Gormenghast trilogy. And then, of course, you know, his grandson and his daughter-in-law, of course, are very well-known artists now. You know, Phyllida de Barlow and her son Eddie Peake or whatever. But, you know, I only made that connection quite recently. I didn't realise. But there's a kind of horror and a kind of gothic horror to that book. And it's also kind of captivating and kind of page-turning. And I've liked it since I was a teenager. And I reread that. But, you know, it's a close call between that and Kafka. Anything Kafka or the three books, you know.
I might write that down. Gormenghast trilogy. Yeah. Where's that set?
It's a fantasy.
Right.
Yeah, it's a fantasy world that he creates, set in a kind of semi kind of medievally kind of world where.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Titus Groan is the main character, and it's about his journey from childhood as the kind of lord to king, and then the things that happened to him along the way, and how the final book is a kind of redemption. It's a three-book series,
And I love it.
We'll do film now. Film.
Fuck.
It's going to be hard, I know. It's a...
Yeah, I mean, I was a film student, so I get asked this a lot, and it always changes. My favourite film is probably Dirty Dancing. Just because it reminds
me... absolute sense, actually.
Very specific day in my life where nothing was wrong, and I watched it 2 times in a row, and I think it was the birth of my sexuality and, like, lots of beautiful women and Patrick Swayze with no top on, and it was just the enlightenment period I needed, and the soundtrack's fucking sick, and there's all sorts of things wrong with the writing, but I love it.
Brilliant, Nick.
You know what, I can picture it in my mind, and it's a Tarkovsky film, The Area. It's not called The Area, that's one translation of it. What is it called? I've got the bloody DVDs right at the top of the stairs, right there.
Constructivist again, right?
Yeah, I love Tarkovsky movies. I love the way they're shot. I love the pace of them. The Life of Me.
That's art, isn't it? I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. Just the way that every scene is constructed so perfectly.
Yeah, Area is the translation, I think, into German, but what is the translation into English?
I can't remember. Might,
yeah, The Zone.
Ah.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
It's a theme emerging. And then just lastly, and then I'll stop rolling.
I better say something a lot more profound than my last option.
Album.
Album, Astral Weeks by Van Morrison. Ooh, is my favourite album. It's my favourite album.
Beautiful.
It's it was my, again, the enlightenment thing. I was a lot older. I mean, I discovered that album. My dad basically thrust it into me because I was like just mad into hip hop and that's what I liked. And he was just like, just give this a go.
It's one of those albums, if you hear it, it catches your ear. If you can hear that, there's something about the production of it, just jangles on your consciousness. You can there's Astral Weeks.
It's a really violent, trebly album. Like, Van Morrison's voice in it is fucking loud on it in the mix. It's a really, like, fucking potent mix. So it should cut through any environment.
That was... Did you see Van at Glastonbury?
I wouldn't bother watching it live. He fucking changes.
It had a big effect on me. I was bursting. I was in bits. It was Sunday night, you know, it'd been a long weekend. And I've been through the, you know what I mean? And I was like, I just fucking collapsed with tears.
It might be amazing. 28 piece band. I just think if you get Van Morrison on a bad day, he's going to ruin it for you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I've got a good story about Van Morrison.
Come on then, drop it, Nick.
Well, I was...
This is what we're here for.
Like late 80s, you know, I used to occasionally do press photos for New Order when I was, you know, young, and we were at Peter Gabriel's Real World Studios, and it was the England-Ireland, like, World Cup or European Championship match, and him and Peter Hook went off at each other.
Didn't go off, no!
It was really funny.
Hook and Gabriel, and then going off at the football.
Yeah, it was funny, yeah. Oh, I can't remember exactly what happened.
I like that.
Now, that is a lost moment in culture, right?
Yeah. Well, that's where we're recording. That's where we booked in February.
That's it, Real World. It's amazing there.
Is that the one in Somerset, in Bath?
It's in Bath, yeah.
Yeah.
It's fucking stunning. I can't believe it.
Salisbury Hill.
It is amazing there. Yeah, being in the studio then with them all night, was that place was brilliant when I was a kid, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That was a bit of a gig.
Yeah.
How did you make that? How did that happen? Jesus.
I just got to know them, you know, had a camera going around.
I would have loved to have met you as a sort of 17, 18 year old. You must have been this like this ubiquitous little annoying kid with a camera, poking your head.
But you've got to be, if you want to do something, you've got to be kind of pushy, haven't you? And then that's kind of how it happened.
It must be a testament to your personality, though, because there's a balance between what you're saying.
Right.
And the other side is these people are like, yeah, come along. Because there's loads of people, loads of photographers that I've worked with coming on an album recording, something intimate like that, or a tour. Wanting people to get back. It's interesting that there's probably something you might not understand about how you were wanted.
Right, okay.
Because otherwise people would have told you to fuck off.
Maybe, probably did at some point.
I remember looking at that Jam Sound Effects album.
Yes.
You know, and there's some French kid that turned up at the studio. mm-hmm. and starts doing that vocal over one of those really dark, slow tracks on the album, mm. one of my favourite albums. And I've always been fascinated by finding that French kid, how he made that happen.
Yeah, you know? Right. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, and Nick, album?
Well, it's not really an album, it's a kind of extended track. Yeah, Strings of Life, Rhythm is Rhythm. Oh, yeah, I mean, that's
Derek May.
Derek May. That for me is just the best.
I can hear it now, I'm getting tingling, you know.
Yeah, but the live, you know, the live recording that's on the original vinyl, because obviously he re-recorded it using MIDI so it could be remixed, but the original track that he released is just live.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, I love it. It's just phenomenal.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, Strings of Life.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you're like, a bit young. Honestly. Yeah. It's that a was classic.
Detroit
techno.
Detroit techno, but it kind of, I think it was one of the first real big popular Detroit techno, 88.
Yeah.
Right. Just fucking just amazingly. But if you listen, again, it's one of those things. Back in the day, it sounded dark and edgy. You listen to it now, it's this soaring beauty. And again, really trebly, isn't it? It's really all the upper ranges. It's all keyboard, real high up keyboard. And it don't sound like dark techno anymore. But in 88, because we'd been listening to Rare Groove, you know, it sounded dark and real driving and technologically driven.
Yeah, I've got a test pressing of it now as well.
Nice.
Yeah, someone got me one. Also, I've got just over there, someone just got me very, very kindly the Fool's Totals Turn, like Jeff Travis's test pressing of it, I've now got, which is kind of. It's the second Fool album. And obviously they would try out different pressing plants and they'd make five copies from each pressing plant and one would go to Jeff Chavis and one would go to the band and whatever, and they'd pick on one, and this is, you know, one of those five test pressings from the actual factory that they used in the end.
It's one of the ones they used?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Obviously the test pressings from the factories they don't use are the ones to really have.
Yeah.
Because I've got one of those. The PJ Harvey single Dress, I've got a test pressing from the factory they didn't use of that.
Well, for you, how does it sound? Can you tell why they didn't use it?
I can't, no. But people I know who are musicians can tell, you know,
That's so cool. That's so cool. I'd love to hear stuff like that because you can, like, you know, just try and get an insight.
Yes. Yeah, but my musical skills are not good enough for that.
No, mine neither.
Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, great.
Thanks for listening to Joining the Dots. I've been Mike Fulham. This is a podcast from the makers of Huck Magazine. We hope you enjoyed. If you did, please tell people about it, share it, download it, comment and subscribe. Thanks to everyone involved in this podcast. Thanks to Joe Talbot, Nick Woplington, and all the people behind the story. Thanks also to all the crew at Huck Magazine and TCO London. Thanks to Vince. Thanks to Sonic Alchemist, Rob Taliesin, Owen. Stay tuned for more conversations across culture. See you on the other side.